from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up in forums next hour, in an age of political extremism and legislative gridlock, compromise has become increasingly rare. Why are we so frustrated and baffled by people whose values and votes differ from our own? According to author Jonathan Haidt, the field of moral psychology can help answer that question. His new book, The Righteous Mind, Why Good People Are Divided by Politics and Religion, explores the moral roots of political division. He'll join us in studio for the hour. That's next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum. Jonathan Haidt joins us for this forum hour. For years, professor of social psychology at the University of Virginia, he presently is Thomas Cooley Professor of Ethical Leadership at the NYU Stern School of Business Organization and the author of a book called The Righteous Mind, Why Good People Are Divided by Politics and Religion. His previous book was The Happiness Hypothesis, Finding Modern Truth and Ancient Wisdom. And he joins us in studio for this forum hour. Good to have you here. Welcome.
Thank you, Michael. Good morning.
Good morning to you. Well, this is a book about human nature, and you're going in depth into truly trying to understand what divides us, politics and religion. Very ambitious book, I must say. Let's begin with kind of what I see as an equation here. Intuition before reasoning and reasoning to justify intuition.
That's right. Think about how we make judgments of any kind. If you see somebody who's beautiful, if you see a landscape that's attractive, do you first weigh up what are the pros and cons, or do you just have an instant reaction within a tenth of a second? The answer is whatever the latter one was, the tenth
the
of a
blink,
second.
The blink.
The blink. That's right.
We'll
exactly.
Right.
And our moral judgments are no different. We then engage in moral reasoning because you don't have to provide reasons. If you say, oh, that's a really beautiful landscape, someone's not going to say, really? Justify that. I don't believe you. But if you say, well, I think gay people shouldn't be allowed to marry, someone might say, really? Why? Justify that. So we're always reasoning. We do a lot of moral reasoning, but it's not to find the truth. It's to prepare for argument.
And it has a lot to do, analogously to you, with sort of like taste buds. I mean, you know, or we're repelled by certain tastes and we're drawn to certain tastes.
That's right. So to think about anything complicated, we need a metaphor. And a common metaphor that people have used for morality throughout the ages is math or logic. Plato and Kant and many of the philosophers told us you calculate, you reason, it's logic. But in fact, there's a wonderful metaphor from David Hume, the 18th century British philosopher, who said that actually reason, morality is much more like taste. He wanted to make the science of morality be really a science of taste. And you got to document what are the taste buds if you want to begin that science.
If indeed there is a science to know taste buds, I mean, sometimes taste seems to be almost inexplicable or something beyond our ken in many ways. Actually, you mentioned David Hume, and when I first read that in your book, I thought of Isaac Babel, who said passion rules the universe. I mean, to some degree, it's more passion that we're drawn to than it is to reason anyway.
Well, that's right. I mean, one of Hume's most famous statements was, reason is and ought only to be the servant of the passions and can never pretend to any other office than to serve and obey them. So yes, and this was an insight that you find in many cultures that passion rules and reason follows.
So somehow, and I want to talk about both politics and religion with you, but somehow probably make a lot of listeners angry when they hear this notion. Conservatives maybe are more broad-minded than liberals?
The way to put it isn't broad-minded per se. Let's just focus on taste buds. Imagine a cuisine that focuses on, say, two taste buds, sweet and sour, or versus imagine a cuisine that uses all of the taste buds, including bitter and umami or savory. You can't really say that one is better than the other, but you can say that one draws on more taste buds. And so my colleagues and I, we have a website at yourmorals.org. We've collected data from about 250,000 people. And what we show is that there are about six different psychological foundations or taste buds, if you will, of the moral sense, and that liberals tend to rely on the first one primarily, that is care, harm, compassion, those sorts of issues, those sort of tender-hearted issues. Also fairness and liberty, but especially care and compassion.
When you say fairness, you also mean reciprocity, I think, don't you?
That's right. Well, everybody thinks they favor fairness. Everybody in America thinks our side favors fairness and liberty and their side doesn't. The psychological meaning of fairness is really proportionality. That is, are you getting in proportion to what you're giving, or are you cheating? And we're all really, really attentive to whether everyone else is cheating. I would ask your listeners to reflect on whether they have ever lived in a group house where they shared a kitchen. And I would ask them to think, how well did that go? How much harmony was there versus everyone always thinking, hey, he took too much mayonnaise. Hey, he never does the dishes. So we're really vigilant about this stuff. That's what fairness is really all about.
Yeah, and religion and politics also, when you find polarization, and you do, of course, so find so much polarization, you often find, well, they say that, but then they really say the other thing. It's often the search for hypocrisy that says that pretty much extinguishes or in some ways diminishes what the person is taking a position on.
Exactly, because that's what our righteous minds do. They play lawyer, not scientist. If you try to justify, I'm an academic, I tend to talk with liberals, and in my research, I'm trying to help people understand liberals and conservatives. So whenever I present, well, actually, conservatives care about X, the first thing out of everyone's mouth is, oh, yeah, they say they care about X, but then why do they support Y? Because that's what our reasoning does. We're preparing for our day in court.
But you do say conservatives are more moral.
No. I don't say they're more moral. I say that they use more taste buds. And this leads to a real problem for liberals because there is no taste bud. There is no basic moral concept that liberals use that conservatives just don't get. Now, they may care less about oppression, but they understand it. But if you look at the other way around, conservatives care a great deal about group loyalty, respect for authority, and a sense of sanctity or purity.
Which are all part of moral systems or moral foundations.
Most moral systems.
So
right, especially
if conservatives are
drawn
to more of those six than liberals, then conservatives become, don't they, sine qua non, more moral than?
To say that they, well, you can't, you know, let's see, what would be an analogy here? I mean, okay, suppose I say that, Miró used more colors than did Picasso. Oh, well, he must be a better artist. No, it's not just that more is better. But if conservatives use these loyalty, authority, and sanctity foundations, and liberals tend to say, what? Group loyalty? That has nothing to do with morality. That's like racism. That's like in-group, out-group. So if liberals don't even understand sometimes how group loyalty, respect for authority, and a sense of sanctity are moral concerns, then what happens is liberals don't understand conservative positions on issues, and then they go looking for other motives. And those other motives tend to be greed and racism. So on the left, people tend to interpret Republican actions as basically motivated by greed and racism, and then they're just puzzled and amazed and horrified that Americans are voting that way. So I think there's a fundamental misunderstanding by the left of the right. And that's actually what got me into political psychology in the first place, was to help liberals understand conservatives.
One of the things that's always puzzled many, and I know some of these times these liberal conservative lines can be pretty mushy, to put it mildly. I mean, there are many people who have elements of both.
Oh, libertarians in particular, yes.
But, I'm often reminded of when people hear, for example, that someone like Al Gore gave very small amounts to charity, and somebody like Dick Cheney gave huge amounts to charity. It doesn't equate in their mind. It doesn't seem to be part of reason. Mm-hmm. Because how can a conservative like Cheney, a warmonger as they see it, and somebody like that have charitable or philanthropic impulses? Mm-hmm. And how can someone like Gore, who's trying to save the planet, be much more the other way? This is kind of the complexity of human beings.
But that's normal. So that's why – so the title of my book, the subtitle is Why Good People Are Divided by Politics and Religion. Because all of us, not every individual, but certainly every group is good in the sense that they care about the state of the world. They're not just being selfish. If you get involved in politics, it usually is not for self-interest. It's because you have ideals. And that's true on both sides. Now, as for the kinds of acts of hypocrisy that you just mentioned, my view as a psychologist is that our behavior and our moral judgments are almost unrelated. Our thinking is done to engage in the realm of defense and offense verbally. Our behavior is caused by all sorts of other forces. And so we often find these disconnects. I mean, Newt Gingrich has been much in the news and, certainly is one of the champions of hypocrisy in our political era for being a man of family values, despite his many, many wives left under very bad circumstances. So hypocrisy is normal. Now, it's good for us to play gotcha and to call people out on it, but that's just the psychological design of the species.
Well, in fact, Emerson Emerson said it, you know, hypocrisy and the hobgoblin of little people and inconsistency and all that. Hypocrisy may be more the essence of life. We're talking, by the way, if you just join us, with Jonathan Haidt, who is the author of The Righteous Mind, and he'll be at the Mechanics Institute this evening at 6:45. And we're talking about some of these differences that exist between particularly people. Well, they're like, it's not only taste buds. You kind of analogize it to being on different teams. Mm-hmm. And that sets up a lot of the polarization, whether it's, you know, I'm on the religious team, I'm on the new atheist team, or I'm on the political conservative side, I'm on the political liberal side. And because the identification is with teams or with one's loyalty to that team and the ideas and the reason behind that team, it often becomes locking horns and pretty unseemly.
Mm-hmm. That's right. So the biggest speculative bubble in the social sciences in the 20th century, I would say, is the idea that we are fundamentally selfish. And all the social sciences got on board. Political scientists told us people vote for their self-interest. Economists said, rational choice theory. Evolutionists said selfish gene theory. And, you know, we all evolved to be selfish individualists. But while there's some truth to that, a more correct way to look at human nature is to say we're fundamentally groupish, and this is really the secret of our survival. All of us here on the planet today, we are not descended from the most selfish bastards who managed to beat out their neighbors. We are descended from the successful tribalists, from the groups that managed to beat out the neighboring groups. Our brains, our minds, our souls are designed for groupish competition, and we love it. We love that so much that we invented sports. It doesn't do anything except let us practice our groupishness. And we love sports so much that we invented fandom. And people, you know, paint their bodies and freeze on a Saturday morning to go to a football game to root for a bunch of guys that they don't know, who probably aren't even from their hometown. You know, it's all just a kind of a game that we play because we just love groupishness.
But groupishness leads to zealotry and zealotry to fanaticism and all the rest of that we see. Somebody sees in Los Angeles somebody wearing a giant shirt and wants to attack him, you know, that sort of thing.
But
you know?
Fortunately, in our country, not so much. So intergroup competition tends to be generally healthy. This is something that I think I really want to get across, especially to people on the left who are reflexively distrustful of groupishness. So obviously, you couldn't have genocide and war without groupishness. So of course, groupishness carried to its extreme is terrible. But my argument in the book is that if not for our groupishness, there'd be no civilization. Groupishness normally is pretty healthy. So the social psychological finding is when you take a bunch of people, bring them into the lab, divide them into teams, even on minimal criteria, just say, oh, you know, you guys have birthdays in the first half of the year, whatever it is. Divide people into teams. What you get is people tend to now like and trust the people on their team a lot more, but they don't dislike or distrust the other folks. In other words, groupishness boosts the total amount of trust and cooperation. Now, when you put the groups into competition, like with intramural sports, it still is pretty healthy and it's fun for everyone. But then when it gets even more intense, suppose there's some violation or somebody hurts someone, then you can flip the switch into demonization. And that's when you get into, say, British soccer hooliganism, when they really show up in order to punch each other in the face. But that's not what happens in American sports, by and large.
Well, I'm struck by the sense of thinking about Robert Putnam, whom you mentioned in your book, and who's a friend of ours, and he talks about studies that show that diversity doesn't necessarily lead to greater harmony. In fact, almost the antithesis of that. And yet, there's a sort of liberal shibboleth that the more diversity, the better, and so mm-hmm. forth. And you're making a play here for, you know, crossing lines and going across the aisles and finding more harmony between groups and so forth. But when you put them together, according to Putnam, you get more disharmony.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's right. So one of the points of my book, so there are three principles of moral psychology. And the third one, which I think is the most interesting one here, is morality binds and blinds. And so for each team, you have to look at what's their sacred value? What are they binding themselves around? And I believe that at least on the left, since the 1960s, the modern American left, it was called the New Left back then, has focused on race issues, on racial justice, civil rights issues, including then women's liberation. So those were very important issues. They're issues on which the left basically won, thank God. But what happened as a result is as they circled around racial justice issues, that was their sacred value. They then go blind to a lot of other things around it. And so diversity is a perfect case in point. Diversity policies are entirely intended to be remedies for racial injustice, and the left then is obligated to say that they are good. And in fact, they're very mixed. If you want people to get along, don't emphasize differences. You should emphasize commonalities. And this is Putnam's point. What Putnam found empirically, he's a political scientist at Harvard, and what he found empirically is that when you look at how diverse communities are, diversity basically decreases trust. It makes everybody stay home and not join groups. So it's unpleasant for the left to hear, but it's a basic, it's just an important kind of fact that the people need to understand.
There have become so many things that are not only unpleasant for the left to hear, but unpleasant for the right to hear, unpleasant for, I mean, you have new atheists as soon as they hear, and you in print and I in print have defended people of religious belief because we see them as often being moral people who want to do good, but as soon as some of the new atheists hear somebody is inclined toward religion, it becomes like a red flag. And there are those, of course, who are fundamentalists. As soon as they hear somebody's in favor of, say, same-sex marriage, it becomes a red flag. You want to create more compromise, don't you?
That's right. That's right. So the problem in our society is not religious people or atheists. The problem is fundamentalists. Morality binds and blinds. So anybody who says, this is sacred, I am totally right about it, my team is totally right, and the other team is totally wrong and evil. So what Putnam found is that people who are members of religious communities tend to be better citizens, more charitable, better neighbors. They join organizations. So religion isn't the problem. But then you get the fundamentalists who, like that guy in Florida who wanted to burn a Quran, and it was a very sick sort of church involving just his family members, not a sort of an open, real congregation. There's a sense in which the new atheists are sort of like that on the left, as it were. They sacralize science. They say science is almost like God in a sense.
But they also see the horrors of what's done in the name of religion. They see beheadings and they see wars and they see...
Well, that's right. They see only the bad because they sacralize science and they see religion and science as being mortal enemies. And of course, there have been quite a lot of conflicts over the teaching of evolution. When there's an intergroup competition, you tend to get polarization. And the intergroup competition between science and religion in the 90s over creationism, I think, led to the rise of the new atheist, that is, these sort of militant atheists. I mean, I'm an atheist, but I don't hate religion. It's an empirical question whether religion is a net good or a net bad for society. In some societies, it might be a net bad, but the empirical finding in America is that religion is a net good. So I think there's a basic scientific issue at stake here, a basic descriptive issue, and the new atheists are wrong in their characterizations of science, at least in the United States.
Well, in religion and politics, you just hit certain people. People's nerves, and they become immediately responsive. In fact, you know, probably I was reading one of your blogs, and you were saying you have respect for Glenn Beck for his coherent moral vision, and you were talking about your respect for Tom Sowell. To many liberals, mm-hmm. just those names
yes.
will get them agitated and mm-hmm. really angry at you, and mm-hmm. suddenly you lose your credibility because yeah. you respect Glenn Beck or Tom Sowell.
Mm-hmm. That's right. So let me say straight out, I do not respect Ann Coulter. In other words, what I'm getting at here is not whether I agree with people. It's whether I think what they say is based on a sincere moral vision of what they want for the country. And I think Glenn Beck is sincere, Bill O'Reilly. Thomas Sowell is a wonderful philosopher. I've actually found him to be very persuasive. Whereas Ann Coulter, I think, is a showwoman in terms of so it's not that I'm saying all these right-wing folks are good or right. I'm just saying most of them are sincere. And they're asking the same question about the people on the left. Can they really believe what they say? Morality binds and blinds. It's just very hard for us to understand the people on the other side.
Who's more blinded? I mean, does the left misunderstand the right more than the right misunderstands the left? Or do religious people misunderstand atheists more than atheists misunderstand religious people?
In terms of left-right, there's two different things going on. So there is research showing that liberals are more comfortable with ambiguity, complex ideas. They're more interested in new ideas and education. So on average, you would expect...
But won't eat at Applebee's. I saw your TED Talk.
Well, that's right. That's right. Yeah, because they want more variety and diversity. There's a basic trait called openness to experience. So if all else is equal, on average, you would find... And there's research by Phil Tetlock on cognitive complexity. You find more cognitive complexity left of center. Now, as people get far left, then it declines on both sides. Extremists are less complex. But there are reasons to think that liberals would have more complex thinking in general. Now, working against that, though... is the fact that, as I said, liberals tend to make their moral appeals based primarily on issues of care and compassion and then also some fairness and liberty, but they have trouble thinking about these other three foundations, whereas conservatives can think in all six. So I wouldn't say that either side is wiser than the other, smarter than the other, or more broad-minded. Each one has its own sort of stumbling block to thinking properly about the other side.
Our guest again is Jonathan Haidt. His new book is called The Righteous Mind, and he'll be at Mechanics Institute in San Francisco this evening at 6:30. If you would like to join us and join this conversation, you're certainly cordially invited to do that. Our toll-free number is available to you now, and we welcome your calls. It's 866-733-6786. Again, feel free to join the program. Toll-free number, 866-733-6786. There are a number of other ways to join us, as you probably know by now. You can email us, forum@kqed.org, or send your questions and comments to us via our website, which is kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment, or go to our Facebook page and let us know what you're thinking and join the conversation that way. Again, your questions and your comments and your interactivity is welcome here, and we would certainly like to hear from you, and we'll bring in as many of you as we can into the discussion. There is this old notion, and you touch upon it, that you hear from liberals particularly, and again, I must tell you, because I'm a great admirer of Orwell, I'm always a little uncomfortable with that word liberal or the word conservative.
Well, we use it strangely in this country.
People are mixed. I mean, I know, you know, there were people who were social conservatives, but they're politically liberals and vice versa and so forth. But the idea that people would vote against their own interests, their own self-interest, mm-hmm. you heard this particularly during the Bush years. You know, how could working class people, for example, mm-hmm. vote for Bush and Cheney when they don't realize that it's not in their best interest to do that? And you say what?
Well, so as I was saying before, we were sold a bill of goods by saying in the 20th century, oh, everybody's selfish. And so isn't it amazing that people would vote against their self-interest? Voting is not about self-interest. Voting is a religious act. Politics is like religion. You cannot understand human politics unless you understand religion. And the ability we have to circle around sacred values and then fight for a vision of a better world. So on the left, people will be fighting for a vision of a better world, which means getting policies that will help the poor. So it seems as though, my God, if poor people are voting against us, then, you know, or working class people are voting against us, they're voting against their self-interest. But, you know, as is often pointed out, everybody votes against their self-interest. Wealthy liberals vote against their self-interest in voting for higher taxes. When working class whites in particular vote Republican, it's not that they're voting – it's not so surprising that they're voting against programs that might give them more money. They are offended by programs that, as they see it, undercut the work ethic and reward laziness or failure. They're upset. They see these as basically unfair. So when working class whites were voting Republican, they were voting for the kind of world they wanted to live in. It's not a contradiction at all. It's not puzzling. Everybody votes for their morals, not their material interests.
They also vote often ideologically. I'm thinking, for example, of this conservative notion that if you do raise taxes, it will mean that jobs won't be created. And that's an equation that many conservatives mm-hmm. swear by, live by, and people like Norquist right. make Republican legislators fall prey.
That's right. I think that's a great example because there is an economic reality here. There are questions that economists can settle, and it's an open empirical question. If the rich get more money, if they have more money in their pockets, will they hire more people? That's an open question, and the answer appears to be no. There's a wonderful talk, if you Google Nick Hanauer, H-A-N-A-U-E-R, Nick Hanauer. He gave a talk at TED recently and argues, I think very, very convincingly, that the only reason businessmen hire someone is if there are going to be sales to be made. Nobody says, hey, I got extra money, let me hire someone. So the only way you can stimulate hiring is by creating a class of people who can afford to buy things. And so tax cuts for the rich will do nothing for employment, whereas unemployment benefits, helping the states, anything that puts money in the hands of the unemployed or the working class, that will lead to hiring. So, you know, that's a case where I think the Republicans have circled around their sacred value is no new taxes, help the rich. Well, that's not help the rich, but anyway, both sides are blind.
Jonathan Haidt here with us in studio, professor of psychology at the NYU Stern School of Business, and he's the author of The Righteous Mind. When we return, we'll bring you into the conversation. You're listening to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. You're listening to Forum. In an age of political extremism and legislative gridlock, compromise has become increasingly rare, and that's particularly true with respect to religion. Why are we so frustrated and baffled by people whose values and votes and, well, beliefs are different from our own? According to author Jonathan Haidt, the field of moral psychology can help answer that question in his new book is The Righteous Mind, Why Good People Are Divided by Politics and Religion. Exploring the moral roots of political division, he is a professor of psychology at the NYU Stern School of Business and also the author of The Happiness Hypothesis, Finding Modern Truth and Ancient Wisdom. And you can actually meet him this evening. He'll be in San Francisco at the Mechanics Institute at 6:30, appearing there.
6:45,
excuse me. Let's talk just for a moment before we go to our callers about, you say moral systems prize order, social systems rule us, and there's a kind of a real binary in between those two. But we're also talking a little bit off air about the wisdom of repugnance, a guy named Leon Cass, who you quote in your book. That is, some people are just repulsed by the idea of people of the same gender sleeping together, and then they reason it out in their mind or they try to justify it and so forth. And yet a lot of what we respond to, what we think is moral, may just have to do with taboo of one sort or another. I mean, incest is a good example of that, it seems to me. And this is not a case for incest, but to try to justify in terms of reason why we're repelled by incest or the idea of incest, or reasons why one would justify with reason the moral intuition or the repugnance of
that's
it,
right.
It becomes a kind of labyrinthine exercise, doesn't it?
That's right. It's a fascinating one. This is one of the first things I studied in graduate school when I was beginning to study moral psychology, and I was beginning to think that, oh, wow, the emotions are really what's in charge here. I started studying the emotion of disgust because as I was reading accounts of morality in other cultures, and I also read the New Testament, the Old Testament, the Quran, so much of it was about, you know, don't touch menstruating women and don't eat this food and dispose of bodies that way. So much of it was about disgust. So the conclusion that my advisors and I came to is that disgust is this emotion that evolved to help us guard our mouths, to help us protect ourselves from eating contaminated foods. But human beings and human societies are so creative that we've reused this emotion of disgust to guard our social order. And so we do things a certain way. And when people violate that, especially if it involves the body in any way, we're disgusted by it. And that's one of the tools we use to sort of enforce our way of doing things. And so disgust especially shows up around food and sexual acts, which is why it's so common for societies to taboo homosexuality. It's not the normal way of doing things. Actually, in some societies it is, and there they don't have the disgust taboo. So it is somewhat arbitrary. In our own society, disgust has dogged civil rights issues for a long time. If you look, I spent many years teaching at the University of Virginia, and in the South, it was illegal for black and white to drink at the same water fountain. It was all these biological things. It was food, water fountains, bathrooms. And now gay people are the victim of it. A lot of the opposition to gay marriage turns out to be based on just feelings of disgust.
And I use taboo sort of in some ways connected to that or in tandem with that, because I think that when you look at the work of many anthropologists, it shows that the repugnance, whatever it is, can be an extraordinary prohibition as far as behavior is concerned, especially in tight-knit groups, to use your word, or communities.
Mm-hmm. You know? That's right. Repugnance, disgust, it's a very, very powerful way of rejecting things. And for example, on the left, there's a disgust, there's a repugnance at any kind of racism. And I think that serves a good function in general. It's not that we can do away with disgust entirely, but we have to reexamine it now. And then especially when there's a large class of victims, people used to be disgusted by interracial marriage. And thank God, people pushed against that, got that turned over, and in time, it's not disgusting anymore. And I think the same thing is clearly happening with gay marriage. Young people don't really, they don't have the visceral.
They don't care.
They don't care.
For the most part,
the issue is going to go away within 10 or 20 years, fortunately.
Well, let's go to our callers, and we'll go to you first, Glenn. Good morning.
Good morning. I also work in academic psychology and in transpersonal psychology, which is very much at the edge of science and religion. And with respect, regarding these two figures of respect for authority and group loyalty, you know, I consider myself a progressive, and I actually do think in those terms. I think it's incorrect to say that liberally inclined people don't think about those, but I consider speaking truth to power as part of my responsibility to engage with people facilitating the role of authority. That is my moral service to them, and I consider that expressing and developing carefully a diversity of opinions is part of my service to the groups that I belong to the society that I belong to. So to say that I don't think in those terms. I don't use those flavors. I find that to be really missing the point of some of the moral thinking that I use.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, Glenn, thank you for that. The way so first, what we find in my research with my colleagues at yourmorals.org is that it's a relative difference. It's not that liberals don't have any concept of group loyalty. But if you take a question like this, it is more important to express yourself than to be a team player. Well, liberals tend to agree with that, and conservatives are much less likely to. So we find a relative difference. And now, even the way you expressed it, the way you described it, fits with the general picture I paint in the book of how left and right are like yin and yang. So I think we can all agree that power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. And I think the historical role of liberalism going back to the 18th century is to speak truth to power. It's to stand up to the king and clergy who, if left unchecked, will take all the power for themselves. So I think liberalism does historically play exactly the role you said, as a check on power, as something that questions group loyalties of tribe and nation and pushes for universalism. So I think
You're talking about liberals moving towards something as a group, and then they do have group loyalty. I mean, the Occupy movement even has loyalty among its own members.
Yes, but it's kind of difficult to watch. I mean, they are so focused on inclusiveness that they can't really mark out boundaries. I've attended a few of their sessions.
I agree with you on that. Yeah.
And you know, if the Tea Party is not all that organized either, but they can get a lot of stuff done because on the right they do authority and loyalty.
But when we were protesting against the war in Vietnam, or when I was involved in protests for civil rights, I mean, there was group loyalty. There was a sense of solidarity.
Well, that's right. Solidarity is very interesting because it's a little different from group loyalty. Solidarity is the response when there's oppression. So when an alpha male arises, when there's some oppressive power, there is an urge to come together to fight the power. So I think liberals are more prone to do that than conservatives. But sort of more tribal group loyalty, us versus them, that appears to be more of a strength of the conservatives. Just think, which job would you rather have in the U.S. Congress, the Democratic whip or the Republican whip? If your job is to keep together your group of congressmen, boy, it's a lot easier if you're a Republican.
And Glenn, I thank you for the call. I remember the TED lecture you gave. It's pretty funny and entertaining to an audience to see. You have I want you to describe this. You have the picture of Michelangelo's David, mm-hmm. and then you have two people looking at it and their responses to it. Mm-hmm. And what you're really trying to show is liberal conservative.
Yeah. Well, that's right. So this comes from work by Robert McCrae, a personality psychologist who did research on the big five traits. And he says that openness to experience is the trait that most differentiates left and right. And there's a lot of research to back him up. We find that, too, at Your Morals. And if you look at art, the kind of art liberals like versus conservatives, it's, you know, much more avant-garde, speak truth to power, break down boundaries and traditions. Conservatives tend, on average, again, people are very variable, but if you're just looking at the averages, to like more traditional forms of art. And this is always a part of the culture war. The arts are always part of the culture war. I mean, even in Nazi Germany, you know, Hitler wanted certain kinds of art forms, and they are things that we would now consider to be ugly and, well, certainly conventional. So you find that with food preferences too. And this was the joke about Applebee's that, you know, I'm an academic in the very, very liberal world. The only time I've ever been to an Applebee's was like the one time I went out, there was one conservative professor that I know, you know, so he goes to Applebee's. I mean, it's just not something that liberals do. It's too conventional and predictable.
Here we go to Santa Clara. Duncan, you're our next caller. Welcome to Forum. You're on the air.
Thank you, man. A great show today. I introduced myself. I'm going to present, frame a question from the conservative standpoint, although I call myself a liberal. Two must reads: Thomas Sowell's A Conflict of Visions and Sam Harris's The Moral Landscape, each for their value in contributing to this very subject matter of ongoing discussion. Mr. Haidt, I'm a respondent to your survey at yourmorals.com. And I'm also an NYU grad, so go Violets, GBA class of 88. Sam Harris wrestles with David Hume, and he takes what I call the conservative standpoint. If Hume has stated that reason must be the tool, the subject to our passions, Harris argues from his utilitarian standpoint that's not wrong, that's not correct. My question to you is that can we transcend, can we reach philosophy and persuasion through the academic research that you're doing? And I think it's a quality and worthy effort. But to what extent does the settling of this argument between the Humes and the Harrises lead you through your research to be persuaded or changed from either a liberal to a conservative starting point or vice versa? And the reason I ask that is that it seems to me that our philosophical antecedents stemming from our first experiences youth and the structure of our primary education and our first exposure to ideas shape this liberal versus conservative dichotomy. Is it possible, having parsed and analyzed and coming to understand the liberal versus conservative predispositions, for one to take from your research, if not from the literature, a revisit to their starting points as to how we solve these questions?
I think we've just come to the question, Duncan.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. So first, on the two books, on Soul's A Conflict of Visions, yes, that is a must-read, I think, for people on the left. It really helped me to understand the moral vision of social conservatives in particular, about the need for constraint. On the Harris book, I have a rather different verdict from you. Harris and I are sort of intellectual opponents on this point. I think Harris... his philosophy is basically that there are two kinds of things in the world. There are truths, like those of physics, and then there's just subjective opinion. But a lot of philosophers point out there are other kinds of truths. There are emergent truths. For example, there are truths of the market. There are truths that are true because of the kind of creatures we are. So when I grade a student's paper, I'm not just saying I like it more. Some papers really are better than others. And Harris doesn't account for that kind of truth. He thinks either it's a truth like physics or it doesn't exist. And moral truths are not like the truths of physics. That's what he wants to say. So I think his philosophical argument fails because he just doesn't take account of the kinds of emergent truths that we live in. It's a wonderful, one of my favorite sentences in all of the social sciences from Clifford Geertz: man is an animal suspended in webs of significance that he himself has spun. And that, I think, is the way to understand our moral lives.
I see an arachnid when you give that quote.
No, that's great, but that's what's so cool. And moral psychology is like a magic flashlight that helps you see those webs.
Let me thank the caller. Here's a web comment. I'm a proud liberal, can definitely assert that I don't understand how the principle of respect for authority is any gauge of morality.
Okay, I'm happy to comment on it. So, again, this is one of those yin-yang things. If you go to my website at righteousmind.com, I have a blog post from somebody who is really sort of angry about authority, doesn't have any respect for authority, doesn't think children should defer to their elders. And this is a view that you find especially on the far left and among anarchists. The view that I came to in my book is that moral order is a miracle. It is a miracle that we're actually sitting here today talking, cooperating, working together, even though we're not kin. That's the miracle I set out to study. How does our species manage to work together so well? And part of it is that we're able to come together under rules and laws that are enforced to some extent by authorities and that require some respect for authority to administer. And so, you know, it's like a Rorschach test, and people on the left will focus more on the fact that authority tends to go too far, tends to be abusive, and that's true. But the alternative, no authority, tends towards anomie or decay. And so I follow the sociologist Emil Durkheim, who was liberal himself, but was trying to understand the origins of order in France 100 years ago, who wrote about the need for respect for authority, respect for rules, respect for traditions, that those are valuable.
Again, Jonathan Haidt's newest book is called The Righteous Mind, and here's a listener who writes, I question whether conservative or liberal are even valid labels for people. It seems more like terms popularized by media pundits, demagogues, and partisans. I am both in various aspects. Simple dichotomy, is it really a valid measure of human psychology? I think most who self-identify as solely either likely heard the term in the media.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, yeah, the terms are oversimplifications, and especially the way we use the word liberal in America is all screwed up. Liberal is supposed to mean following liberty, valuing liberty. And so to say that you are economically conservative because you favor the free market is a contradiction in terms. Europeans use the word liberal more correctly than we do. But if you just think about the left-right dimension, now I'm speaking as a psychologist who my goal is not to explain every person. It's to make some sense of the vast variety that we see. the left-right dimension does have some psychological reality. Now, in other words, some people are just more open to experience, novelty, change, progress. Other people like things that are more familiar, traditional, ordered. So there is some reality to that. That's the psychology. But what does it mean to be a liberal or conservative today? Well, that's not a straight read off our psychology. That has a lot to do with our recent history. And it's kind of strange if you think about it that, say, liberals or people on the left are pro-choice. They are not – they don't have any sympathy or concern for the fetus. You would think that since liberals tend to be more compassionate, which is what we find, that they would be compassionate about an unborn child as well. But because of the history of the issue, liberals are focused on women's rights. And again, very appropriately, they've fought for abortion rights. I'm just saying that the particular positions we hold today are all mixed up based on the recent history, and both sides are contradictory. So if the caller is concerned that there are not just two kinds of people, yes, that's absolutely right.
Well, pro-choice and pro-life is also so anchored in religious beliefs. I mean, I was just talking about this last night at an event John Boland, the president of KQED, and I were at, how, you know, when you get into the whole abortion debate, it's a thicket that you can't get out of in many respects, because there are people who say this is life, it's the sanctity of life, mm-hmm. I respect life. And the other side says, you don't respect my right reproductively to do what I want. And both take a very almost what you would call a sacred attitude toward that, and a righteous mm-hmm. attitude toward that.
Yeah, that's right. And I just made one of the biggest mistakes of my radio career by simply bringing up the topic. I just have alienated so many of your listeners. So let me first say, please understand that I very strongly support abortion rights, especially in the first trimester. But I do understand conservatives who are concerned about, you know,
demonized even for saying something like, yeah. I respect those people who feel that it's a right to life because a fetal life is life, mm-hmm.
right.
or because they believe it in their religion.
Right.
You could be demonized for that.
Yeah, I mean, that's right. I know it's too late. I've blown it already. I'm sorry.
It's all right. You know,
okay.
You still have
well, maybe
still have
I can win a few back.
Here's Martha, who writes, I'm a Catholic, and I support my church's position on most sexual and family values issues. However, if I want to vote accordingly, I usually must vote Republican, which I cannot do because my Catholic values regarding social justice, fairness, et cetera, don't allow me to support candidates whose party promotes benefits primarily to corporations and the wealthy mm-hmm. to the detriment of the poor, disadvantaged, and God's creation in the environment. So I usually vote Democratic. Please discuss how Catholics like me can feel better about our voting choices.
Oh, boy. Catholicism is so interesting and so wonderful because you're all forced to stay together in one church. The Protestants have the option of shifting, and they basically, you know, like the way General Motors had, you know, one different brand for each segment of the market. Protestant denominations have been able to segregate so that they range from far left to far right. But Catholics have to all stay together in one church, and I think that helps them think better. They encounter views on both sides. So I think there is no easy answer. Catholics are always going to be conflicted. My hope is that both parties will reformulate themselves. I think both parties are wrong on a lot of points. I think, you know, and obviously Jesus cared an awful lot about the poor. He cared more about the poor than he did about homosexuality. I do wish that the Republican Party would show a bit more compassion, a bit more concern about how power corrupts. I don't know when they're going to change or when that's going to happen. But, you know, I think the Democrats reformulated themselves a bit in the 90s. They came back from sort of the far left positions that they had.
A lot of that's pragmatism. But, you know, here's a kind of fundamental question for you from our website. Gerald says, is effective dialogue and compromise even possible between persons with widely divergent moral needs?
Yes. The answer is yes. But the crucial thing is, if they meet on the internet with anonymous names and nothing to bind them together, then no, it is not possible, or at least it's very unlikely. But the key thing to remember about disagreement is that don't just focus on the level of ideas. You have to look at the relationships. If you have a relationship with someone, it opens your heart. And this is part of our problem, is that people used to live in communities in which they were different kinds of people. But in the post-war world, America has been able to self-segregate into what are called lifestyle enclaves. So we now live in different gated moral communities where we never have to come in contact with people from the other side. If we don't have relationships with them, we only encounter them in the form of, you know, these radio talk show hosts that, you know, people don't even listen to. They just read, oh, well, Glenn Beck said X. Isn't Glenn Beck terrible? If that's the way left and right interact, then no, there's no hope. But there is a group based here in San Francisco, Living Room Conversations. And what they try to do is they try to get pairs together. So suppose there's a liberal and a conservative who are friends. And then they have a dinner party at somebody's house. And they each invite their friends. And if if there are personal ties like that and you sit down and you share food, that does things to us. It opens our hearts and that opens our minds. So if we pay more attention to how to foster conditions for mutual understanding, then yes, it is possible.
I think it'd be a great idea to have, Israelis and Palestinians or Pakistanis and Indians, groups that are pro-abortion and anti-abortion people actually sit down and break bread together and get the sense of the humanity of each and be able to talk across. But it doesn't happen. I mean, in fact, people in Washington now, they don't even see each other. There are those who have been advocating that legislators ought to have one place in Washington alone because there's very little contact. They go to their home district. They have two homes and so forth.
That's right.
Don't spend much time in Washington. And so Republicans and Democrats don't talk to each other. They don't have human contact.
That's right. That's one of the causes of our polarization now. Studies of the American electorate show that we've gotten a little bit more polarized on issues, just not much more polarized on issues. We've gotten a little more polarized on what we think about each other. We dislike each other across the divide a little bit more. But Congress has gotten vastly more polarized, much more so than the electorate. And one of the reasons is exactly as you said, that congressmen used to have personal relationships. They used to live in Washington. That means that their spouses served on committees together. They met each other at dinner parties. Their kids went to the same school. So there were relationships. And this allowed them to disagree during the day but still treat each other as human beings. They had relationships. That ended, and Newt Gingrich deserves some of the blame for this. Newt Gingrich set out to change the tone in Congress to make it more confrontational, and he succeeded. One of his innovations was to change the legislative calendar so that everything happened on Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. So it was possible to just fly in Tuesday morning, fly out Thursday evening, not live in Washington. I was on a panel with David Brooks a few months ago, and he said the problem in Washington is the decline of bourbon. They don't drink together anymore.
I was told, I mentioned going on Alamo yesterday with our fearless leader John Bolin and told this great story about Bill Bradley telling a story about when he was in Washington. He didn't even want to be in an elevator with Jesse Helms, didn't want to go near him and so forth. And then one day they got a call because he'd been a professional basketball player and said, Mrs. Helms called and said, our granddaughter wants to be a basketball player. Could you meet? And went out to the park and suddenly Jesse Helms and his wife were there just watching Bill Bradley give his tutoring to the granddaughter.
Right, that human connection, it works.
It was even more than that. It was just, suddenly the Helms were grandparents, you know.
Yeah.
And Jesse Helms was his grandpa, you know. Well, anyway.
Exactly. Again, the subtitle of my book is Why Good People are Divided by Politics and Religion. And this is really what the most important idea I want to get across to listeners is that these moral differences, they seem so threatening to us. They seem like it's good versus evil. But actually, they can be really, really interesting and fun. I imagine people listening to this show, people listening to NPR, tend to be high on openness to experience. They want new ideas. They want new perspectives. Well, the best place to find those is in ideological groups that are not yours.
Well, I take some pride in the fact that we have a very broad swath of listeners, I mean, in terms of political views. I mean, the Bay Area tends to skew left, of course, but we have a lot of conservative people because they want in-depth coverage and they want educational and illuminating radio. So we hold them for those reasons, I guess, or maybe because one likes to think they like the host or they like the people that the host has on or find the fact that we have a lot of conservatives on maybe even heartening. Jim writes, your guest topologies around how we believe explains a lot of our day-to-day political stances, even the enjoyments we have in having our beliefs. However, a more important question for now in our political deadlocks is how do we change? This change does happen, albeit rarely, i.e. civil rights in the South and nationally during the 60s. Can we begin to explore that more? Thank you.
Yeah. So I think that's right. That's the question of the hour. What can we do? And I think there are two different levels to approach it in. Ultimately, in the long run, we're going to have to make some changes to our institutions, for example, to the way that we run elections. It's kind of crazy that most of our congressional districts are safe districts, so whoever gets in wins in the primary, which means the winner is the one who appeals to the people on the far right or the far left. So there are various kinds of electoral reform that would make things go a little better in Washington. I have a website at civilpolitics.org where some political scientists and I try to bring together what we know and what might work on these issues. So there are a variety of institutional reforms. Unfortunately, we have this terrible, terrible Supreme Court decision, the Citizens United ruling, which allows rich guys, and it's basically all rich guys, to funnel money, to do negative ads, and it's all negative ads. So there's going to be a lot more demonization coming down the pike. That's going to be tough. The other level that we can work at is the personal level, the level of individual to individual. And here's where what I'm finding is when people read my book, what they say is, well, you know, it didn't make me any more, it didn't bring me to the center, but it helped me see that the other side isn't stupid and evil. And it made it easier now for me to talk to, you know, my brother-in-law or whatever it is. So I think there's a lot that we can do at the human level to just have conversations that are not demonizing. They're not angry. They're more inquisitive. Like, oh, so, you believe this. Let's talk about this. Why do you think we should have this policy rather than that?
That's sort of the NPR interlocutor's motif, or at least the way we try to conduct interviews to a great extent. Here's Rachel, who says, I love this work and agree with so much of it. In my casual lexicon, I say everyone is drinking their own Kool-Aid. Curious, though, if he puts all moral questions on an equal level or if he sees higher levels of development in some groups, not others. Kohlberg comes to mind. Thank you.
Yeah, that's a good question. So I'm a centrist, and some people say that means that I think everybody's right, and that's not true. I do think that every group, every movement sees some things that others can't see. Everyone is useful. The one thing I can say as a psychologist, and this would, I think, agree with Kohlberg, is that if you are forced to deal with conflicting views, conflicting opinions, it drives you to be more sophisticated in your thinking. Whereas if you are surrounded, in other words, if you're exposed to different kinds of Kool-Aid, perhaps you could say, as opposed to if you're in a community where everybody drinks the same Kool-Aid, everybody agrees, and the enemy is just distant on the horizon, that tends to pull for very poor black and white low-level thinking. And so this is, again, why I think Catholics have a bit of an advantage here, because they're forced to deal with all these different opinions. And I think, you know, Catholics tend to be very heavily represented in bioethical considerations. A lot of Catholic organizations do a lot with moral philosophy, moral thinking. And one thing I hear from conservatives is many conservatives are forced to deal – if you grew up conservative in this country and you're fairly smart and you're educated, you're forced to deal with liberal ideas. But if you're liberal, you know, as I was for almost all my life, I never encountered conservative ideas in school.
If you're a good liberal, you should open up your mind anyway, right? I mean, that's what you say.
You should, but you know, look, we're human. We don't seek out disconfirmation. We seek out confirmation.
Well, here's a good confirmation to end the show with, a good last comment. A listener writes, I'm a free-thinking spiritual seeker and staunch progressive radical politically, and I once had a relationship with a man who was a born-again Christian and staunch Republican. Chemistry, intelligence, and decency brought us together, and the glue of those things allowed us not only to debate but discuss political and spiritual issues. For both of us, our horizons and understanding of the other side expanded through that relationship. I found that he was a good, decent person who wanted the best for humanity, as did I. We just differed mightily on the methods and path to the betterment of the world. Good note to end on. Thank you, Jonathan.
Wonderful. Again, relationships open hearts and open minds.
And the book is The Righteous Mind. Thank you for being with us. I want to thank our interns, Keith Manconi, Ernesto Morales, Dana Varinsky, and Catalina Villegas. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.